A personal journey through the Mid-Atlantic, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post. We'll talk about his new book, States of Mind.
The Mid-Atlantic is literally in between. It's, as we say, betwixt and between. And its character is not as easily defined as those of the South or of New England. I think in substantial measure, as I've come to conclude, that because its character draws from the South and from the North and is an amalgam of the two rather than a very distinct regional character of its own. But the word middle, you know, it's very hard to say when you do a project like this. I try not to start out with preconceptions, but of course the word middle was in my mind, and I kept coming back to it as I drove around.
Critic and columnist Jonathan Yardley. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about his new book, States of Mind, A Personal Journey Through the Mid-Atlantic. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. The search for home is an enduring theme in American life and letters. For Jonathan Yardley, Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic and columnist at the Washington Post, it's lately taken the form of a personal journey through the Middle Atlantic states. Yardley writes about his travels in a new book entitled States of Mind, an effort at once affectionate and critical to define the region, to figure out what sort of place it is. The book seeks to capture the charms, the flaws, and the personalities of places such as Williamsburg, Atlantic City, Chapel Hill, Virginia's Homestead Inn, and West Virginia's Greenbrier. I asked Jonathan Yardley to describe his itinerary in States of Mind.
I thought when I started the book that it would be sort of a Travels with Charlie journey in which I would sort of point the car and see where it took me. And, you know, talk with the locals and all that sort of stuff. It's no favorable reflection on myself, but the fact is I'm not that kind of guy. I stand on the sidelines and look and comment and think about things. I don't get out in the fray as much as I doubtless should. So I ended up writing my own kind of book. I followed my nose to places that interested me, either for personal or familial reasons or because I was curious about them. I mean, more often than not, these are places with that have some particular meaning for me, some emotional resonance. I also went to some places like Atlantic City, Williamsburg, that don't have any, and yet are important parts of the mix that adds up to the Mid-Atlantic.
Williamsburg and Atlantic City were sort of among the low spots of the trip. You had a lot of critical things to say
there.
Well,
that's true. Williamsburg, I'm afraid I have just been unable to connect with. I think that historic preservation is a wonderful thing, but Williamsburg is not preservation. Williamsburg is recreation. There's a big difference. Preservation is Jamestown. Preservation is the little town of Newcastle in Delaware, where we try to keep a place in the closest we can come to what it was like when it was its real self. Mm-hmm. Williamsburg is a theme park, Disney World in a powdered wig. Of course, some valuable archaeological and historical work is done there, but I really do not think that is the principal raison d'etre of Williamsburg. It's a place to make money. Mm-hmm. Atlantic City disappointed me for a different reason. The great rationale for casino gambling when it was finally authorized 15 or so years ago was that it was going to have a trickle-down effect and that everybody in Atlantic City was going to benefit from it, whether they patronized the casinos or not. Well, the fact of it is that there are two Atlantic cities.
Yeah.
There's the sort of glossy... the world of casinos is very weird. I've never been to Las Vegas. I suspect that that's very much alike. It's not full of sort of Dean Martin characters. You know, it's full of very ordinary middle Americans who've gotten onto excursion buses in Toledo.
Yep.
And there was a guy in front of me. He and his wife had been, quote, given a trip to Atlantic City by their son and daughter-in-law. Well, what they'd been given was two nights at the Trump Taj Mahal, but they had to pay for everything else themselves. It struck me as a very peculiar sort of gift. But, you know, they go and they line up at the nickel slot machines. These are not high rollers. They're very ordinary people out to have what I think I'd call in the book a sort of a safe antiseptic toot. But there's that world, and it's very self-contained. It's almost overwhelmingly white and very much middle class. And then there's the world outside of what I think could accurately be called the real Atlantic City, which is very poor.
Very tough times.
Very, very hard, mm-hmm. and very heavily black.
Well, now, if these represent some of the low points on this, these trips that you took, Jonathan Yardley, what were the high points? You got a favorite that you think back on?
Well, the truth of it is that even the things that I was irked at, I found amusement and pleasure in. The whole trip was a high point for me, but I guess if I could only take one, if I had to stick with one thing, it would be going to Frank Lloyd Wright's house, Falling Water, in the Laurel Mountains of Pennsylvania.
There you talk about an integration of form and function.
Well, of man and nature, really. Uh-huh. And I had known about that house since I was I'd known about it for 40 years, since I was a boy. And I don't know, I can be very obtuse at times, and for some reason I had the notion it was in the Midwest. You know, a lot of his great buildings are out there, and he was a Midwesterner, and I just assumed that was where it was. And in the Washington Post a couple of years ago, I ran across one of those feature articles about day trips, and there was Falling Water in Pennsylvania. I thought, my gosh, I've got to do that, because I'd always wanted to see the house. And what, you know, most things that you've thought about for a long time and looked forward to and thought would never happen to you, you'd never see them or whatever, they tend to disappoint you. Falling Water just bowled me over. It was so much more than I could ever have expected. The integration of that building into the landscape, the color, the sound, the you stand in that magnificent second-story living room, and you really feel as though the outside is coming in. And as though you are going out, this extraordinary feeling that the man had for nature. He didn't really design very habitable houses, as he knew himself. He never designed a comfortable chair in his life. And yet, you couldn't even conceive of changing anything in that house, because it was all planned and designed to fit together, to add up to something that meant something. And I was very, very deeply moved by that 3 or 4 hours I spent there, and I think about it a lot. I want to go back. My wife wasn't with me. I want to take her with me, and I hope that it won't be a letdown the second time around.
We're talking about your book, States of Mind, Jonathan Yardley. Are you going to be accused of trivializing the culture, the history of the region by writing about potato chips and beer?
Well, you know, other people can write about battlefields. They know more about them than I do. I've never met a battlefield that I liked. I wrote about Utz potato chips and Rolling Rock beer because I got to thinking about regional food, and the fact is that nobody's ever talked about mid-Atlantic cooking the way they talk about Southern cooking or New England cooking. And I got to think about it. I realized that the most famous dishes of our region are identified not with the region but with the states that they come from: Virginia ham, Maryland crab cakes, Pennsylvania scrapple, and the like. Uh-huh. And so I thought, well, what's some food that is indigenous to us? And I thought, well, here's this really very good commercially manufactured potato chip that's sold to all intents and purposes only in the Mid-Atlantic. And here's this very good beer that is brewed with mountain water from the Mid-Atlantic.
And I'll tell you, after I read that passage, I wanted to go out and mow the lawn and then have a Rolling
have
Rock.
Rolling Rock is an excellent after-mow beer. And I also thought that by this point, this is 80% of the way through the book, I thought that there'd been an awful lot of me, and that I needed to play boy reporter a little bit and just do some descriptive writing and get out of the center of the book myself for a little bit. So I think that chapter, which a lot, you know, it's nothing but a long newspaper article, but a lot of people seem to like it, and I think the reason is that it comes as a change of pace after what's gone before.
Tell me about Chapel Hill. You have a wonderful fondness for Chapel Hill. You graduated from the university in 1961. You come back to UNC and you find changes that you like, mainly changes that you don't like.
Right. The changes that I like most have to do with this university's, I think, quite willing and over the years almost enthusiastic acceptance of new American realities about racial justice. I think Chapel Hill's record is, of course, it's spotty. Everybody's record is spotty on questions of race. But I think that by contrast with most other major universities, Chapel Hill has done a pretty good job of really opening itself up and making itself a genuinely to the extent that any scholarly institution can be genuinely egalitarian, I think Chapel Hill is working on that.
So you're glad that you went to school at UNC and not Princeton?
I am very glad that I did. Princeton's a fine school, but I'd spent 6 years in prep school and I didn't need four more. Yeah. The changes that are obviously more difficult for me and others to cope with are that Chapel Hill, which was literally a little academical village when I came here, is now almost a city. Mm-hmm. And it sprawls and it has gridlock and it has a lot of really genuinely superbly ugly new buildings. And the little campus at the center seems almost lost in the middle of all this sort of junky late 20th century American construction.
Could this be an emblem of your views about education in not just the Mid-Atlantic, but all over the country?
No, I think it reflects more my views about the carelessness with which we have coped with the problem of rapidly expanding population in the latter half of this century. Population expansion is a given. You can't pretend that it doesn't exist, and you have to deal with it. But the utter lack of planning, the utter lack of interest in thinking about, well, what is it that makes this place, say Chapel Hill, what is it that makes it unique, and how do we keep it that way as it grows? Well, of course, the thing is that nobody asked the question, because that's particularly during the 80s, that wasn't the way we did things in this country. We just go out and do them, and then we cope with the consequences when it's too late to rectify them. I found in my visit to Chapel Hill, which was occasioned by my 30th reunion, I found that if I saw it through the eyes of a classmate and dear friend of mine who hadn't seen it for 25 years, that she was able to see how the good things about Chapel Hill had endured through all of this, the essential quality of the place. And I also, she got me to thinking about my sons, one of whom graduated 4 years ago and one of whom graduated 6 years, 7 years ago. And my sons were just as happy here as I was and learned as, it did as much for them as young men and people entering adulthood as it had done for me. I got to thinking, if they love it as much as I do and their feelings about it are just as passionate as mine, then it's still Chapel Hill.
Well, it's happy to reflect on Chapel Hill, particularly in the light of this wonderful basketball victory
right.
that we've just been through as we're taping this conversation. Jonathan Yardley, what does your book tell us about, not only the state of mind, but the state of culture and the way the Mid-Atlantic states have handled the wonderful burden of history that they're heir to?
That's an interesting question that I haven't been asked before, so I can't give you a nice, smooth answer to it. I don't think there's much in this book about culture. Now, do you mean culture in terms of...
Oh, we could talk about mass culture. We could talk about rather more elite culture.
Right.
Just the question of regional identity, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't think, first of all, that the people in the Mid-Atlantic think of themselves as being in the Mid-Atlantic.
Uh-huh.
Southerners, particularly native ones, think of themselves as Southerners. Yankees think of themselves as Yankees. I think people in the Mid-Atlantic are much more likely to identify themselves with either their state or their locality or their country.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there is a particular sense of regional identity. It's an amorphous sort of place. And, that's fine. There are all sorts of different ways in which you can let your roots sink into the earth. My own adopted city of Baltimore is a city of neighborhoods. And I think that I'm thinking about this for the first time, so it's not going to be very coherent, but I think that in a way the Mid-Atlantic is a region of neighborhoods too, of places that are both disalike and alike, places that go their way together and the places that go their way apart.
You talk about how in Baltimore you are minutes away from something that is utterly different from
right.
the neighborhood that you live in.
That's right.
For
well, I live in a sort of waspy neighborhood of mildly prosperous, not rich, but certainly more prosperous than average.
And yeah, that trip to the country club was a bit of a...
Well, the country club is very much out of my own
orbit. Leap across the river there.
Right. But I can take a 5-minute walk in a couple of directions and be in neighborhoods that are very different from my own. But they're still Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I certainly think of myself as a Baltimorean first and a Roland Parker second, but both of those are aspects of my identity. I think that in the Mid-Atlantic, people... I don't think it's ever crossed anybody's mind to say I'm a Mid-Atlanticer or whatever it is we call ourselves.
Right.
But you do say, in the course of my life as a Mid-Atlanticer, I have been successively a Pennsylvanian, a Virginian, a Tar Heel, and a Marylander, as well as a brief stop in in Washington.
Well, now, speaking of Baltimore, Maryland, Jonathan Yardley, again, your book is States of Mind. This is the home of the Sage of Baltimore, H.L. Mencken. Do you think of yourself as having inherited something from Mencken in your role as a cultural critic, as a book reviewer? Here's a guy who's much, very controversial these days.
Well, yes and no. I have a great deal of admiration for Mencken as a prose stylist and as a journalist and as a figure in American literary history. I think he's one of the really titanic figures, and he's a great big monument there.
Despite the fact that he's been accused of being an anti-Semite and a racist.
Well, I have a lot of trouble with that. Sitting here on the table between us is a copy of a book that of his called My Life as Author and Editor that appeared in January of '93, of which I was the editor. And this is a posthumous work of his that was kept under wraps, literally under lock and key, for 35 years after his death. And it follows by, I think, 3 years, the publication of his diaries, which, as you know, caused a great stir about comments he made about Jews and blacks and others that certainly seemed, at first glance, to be racist or anti-Semitic. I don't think there's any conclusive answer to the question of Mencken's attitude on these. I think, and I really mean this quite sincerely, I think if Mencken were, if somehow we could send a pipeline to him and he could see the things that have been written about him and the accusations that have made against him, I think he would be genuinely dumbfounded.
Mm-hmm. He'd also enjoy the press, wouldn't he?
Oh, he would enjoy the press, yes. No question about that. But I think that he literally would be stupefied by the accusations that have been made against him, because the sort of things that he says in the diaries and in this incomplete posthumous book that I edited were said routinely, matter-of-factly, by a great many people who were educated and responsible and prominent and thought of themselves as open-minded and open-hearted. But this was 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. We were a different country. I ran across a review of this book of not long ago that appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, and the reviewer said that I was guilty of some kind of relativism in saying that you cannot apply our current notions about anti-Semitism and racism to people who live to what people did 60 years ago. That I don't think that's relativist at all. Society was different then. Mm-hmm. People spoke about each other and thought about each other in different ways then. Things that we think are not merely just, quote, politically correct, but are truly offensive now were not regarded as offensive then.
Let's broaden the conversation a little bit, Jonathan Yardley. What is the responsibility in our time, you in the 1990s? What is your responsibility as a cultural critic? Do you shape the times? Do you reflect them? How does that work?
I don't think either one of them. I think I'm myself. I certainly don't think I shape them. I think that any journalist, any writer of anything who fancies him or herself to have that kind of power is living in fool's paradise. The most you can ever hope for in my business is influence. And I think the only way that you can have real influence is by being persuasive. Whether I am persuasive is for my readers to decide. I do try to construct my pieces not merely as just bombast and, you know, the random firing off of opinions, but I try to make logical arguments for positions that I'm advancing. I don't think I reflect my times because I'm a little bit, as I said in the title of my previous book, a little out of step. Mm-hmm. My politics are elusive of glib definition. My literary tastes are equally unpredictable. Some of them are very predictable, but others are not at all predictable. And I just think of myself, and I suppose in this one sense, I think of myself as following in Mencken's train. I think of myself as just sort of being a lone rider out there, doing what he does, saying what he says. I'm not a provocateur. I'm not a devil's advocate. The things I say are things I believe, and I don't seem to have a shortage of opinions. I don't think very many people agree with them.
How do you pick the books that you choose to review, Mr. Yardley? I mean, is there a sort of doctrine? Is there a thread that runs through your ideas
No.
here? Does it just happen on a kind of sort No. of case-by-case basis?
I'm a newspaper man. Book reviewing in a newspaper exists not as a form of literary criticism, but as a form of journalism. Mm-hmm. Books in newspapers are there because they're news. I think the first criterion that I look for in deciding whether to review a book is whether it is news. News, in that sense, is a very, you know, there are all sorts of definitions of it. A book by James Michener is not news in the sense that the president's budget is news, but it's news because James Michener has a big following and a lot of people care about it, so that makes it newsworthy.
What about ideas? That is to say, the accusation, I could accuse you of your journalism being driven not by ideas or culture, but by events, by headlines. Is that to trivialize the whole intellectual inheritance that you write about?
I wouldn't make any sweeping claims for myself or my profession as idea driven. Mm-hmm. I would like to say, this again is a question I have not had before, and I think it's a good one and a perceptive one. I would like to say that yes, I am driven by events as my business is, but that I, in commenting on them, I subject those events to my own ideas and convictions. Mm-hmm. I do think that you can read me. You know, I have two hats at the Washington Post. I'm both its book critic and I'm a regular weekly columnist.
Right.
And my literary and some of my social and cultural ideas certainly surface in the book reviews, but the column, which is, some of them were collected in the book I referred to, Out of Step, the column is really where I express myself. And I think that you can read my columns. You might hate them for any number of reasons, but I think you would have to admit that these are pretty consistent expressions of a pretty consistent point of view, of ideas and beliefs that I pick up a subject that's in the news that it seems to me to be worth discussion, and I run it, in effect, I send it through the filter of my ideas and beliefs and see what happens when it comes out.
Let me ask you to reflect here on fiction in the 1990s. Do you have it's always a tough call, you know, favorite writers, mm-hmm. Favorite kinds of fiction. Who would you put toward the top of your list?
Well, the people that I would put toward the very top are either not writing at all or are writing very little. That would be, among living writers, Saul Bellow, Peter Taylor, and Eudora Welty. There are a few of my contemporaries, that is to say, writers in their 50s or late 40s, whom I admire, most particularly Ann Tyler, but Gail Godwin, Rob Foreman Due, some others. I am a very unenthusiastic viewer of the schools of creative writing on the college campuses. I think that they have had a really genuinely deleterious effect on American fiction, American literary fiction. They've moved it out of the mainstream of American life into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Whatever one may say about universities, it must be conceded that even the best of them are really isolated from the day-to-day activities of American life.
You talk about the pernicious, the pernicious deconstructionists in the universities?
Well, they're just silly. In fact, some friends of mine who are closer to the campuses than I am tell me that I'm behind the times, that the deconstructionists have long since passed out of favor, and that something called the new historicists is
that's right.
And I believe since the new historicists have just been written up in the New York Times Magazine, I suspect that's a pretty clear sign that they're on the way out. So.
Well, one of the accusations made against the deconstructionists is that they don't believe in language. You do. Right. You have been accused, as a matter of fact, of, what is it, meticulous syntax? how about that? You take pride in your writing as writing?
Well, yes, I do. But, you know, the deconstructionists, it's not so much language that doesn't interest them. It's
meaning.
It's authors. They regard criticism as more important than the work that is under criticism. I think that's balderdash. Yes, I do take writing very seriously. I have always been proud of my prose, and I've always worked to make it literate and original. And I work in a business where prose style is not really valued very highly, and I do value mine, and I'm very lucky. I've been doing this business for more than three decades, and I've had good editors all the way, and I've learned a lot from people.
Well, that's an impression that I come away from the States of Mind, your new book, with Mr. Yardley. That is to say, you can be tough at times and real harsh, but I get this feeling that you were saying, hey, I really am a lucky guy, all the neat way that I kind of earn my living.
Oh, I can't imagine a better job on earth for me. I don't know how many people there are who would be happy being at home all day reading books and writing pieces and not seeing the outside world as much as you really ought to. But but you know, I get out. I get to a meeting at the Washington Post every week, and I have various ways of going to baseball games and taking long walks and things to get out into the world. But I've got a wonderful job.
Well, let's use that as a jumping off point here. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. You say you go to baseball games. Just tell me quickly, this program won't run until what, maybe June or so of 93. How are the Baltimore Orioles going to do this year?
In June, I would think we'll probably be in third place, but there's a long way between June and September where I really expect to be at the top.
Jonathan Yardley, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings, for stopping by the National Humanities Center. Let me mention a couple of your books. Out of Step, Notes from a Purple Decade, Our Kind of People. That's a sort of memoir of your parents.
My mother and father, right.
And you've written a biography of Ring Lardner. And your new book is States of Mind. It's a wonderful little history of these trips that you took through the Mid-Atlantic.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for coming by the center, and I want to wish you well in your work.
Thank you. It's been my great pleasure.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was Jonathan Yardley, book critic and columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is States of Mind, A Personal Journey Through the Mid-Atlantic, available from Villard Books. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 662. That's program number 662, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, the first of two programs about ancient cultures. Scholars from the University of Exeter, Rice University, Queens College, and the University of Michigan will be here to talk about ritual, ethnicity, and drinking in the world of the ancient Greeks and Romans. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Lights, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. States of Mind, the latest from critic and columnist Jonathan Yardley, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Jonathan Yardley writes for the Washington Post. His new book samples the charms, the flaws, and the personalities of the Middle Atlantic states. From the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright in Pennsylvania to the gambling palaces of Atlantic City and the historical theme parks of Virginia, Yardley explores, criticizes, and praises a frequently overlooked section of the country. States of Mind, A Personal Journey Through the Mid-Atlantic. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.